This episode of AI Meets World is brought to you by Microsoft, making artificial intelligence accessible globally. Keep listening to hear how Microsoft is designing trusted AI innovations that extend and empower human capabilities around the world. Hey, Nev, if you had something wrong with you physically, like you broke your nose at boxing class, or you had a cough you couldn't shake, or something worse, and I am knocking wood as I say this, who would you rather look after you? Bones McCoy in the original Star Trek with a diagnostic tricorder, or the non-threatening, huggable healthcare companion Baymax in Big Hero 6?
I think that as a fellow grumpy misanthrope, I'd rather take Bones. I like his sort of no-nonsense approach. It would feel at least familiar, if nothing else. But I think that if the news were bad, then maybe Baymax could stick around afterwards, because I might need a hug. What about you?
Okay, so I see the value of having the cheerful bedside manner of a Baymax 6 taking care of you when you're not feeling well. And they do say that laughter is the best medicine. But my sister once made me laugh so hard after I'd had surgery on my abdomen that I will never forget it. And now I totally see the benefit of people who just make you smile dryly rather than LOL when you're not feeling great. So I am going with Stone-Faced McCoy as well.
See, like, the interesting thing about this is that both Baymax and the tricorder are sort of two different ideas from fiction about how medical professionals might predict or diagnose medical issues.
Yeah.
And so rather than kind of like replicate the bedside manner of an actual doctor themselves, it's just about the technology that the doctors use.
They're there to help.
This week, we're looking at all things health and medicine as we talk to researchers who are facing the challenges of the modern healthcare system head on, working to predict, diagnose, and treat everything from the common cold to cardiac arrest faster and more accurately than ever before. I'm Navneet Lang.
And I'm Becky Shrimpton. And this is AI Meets World, a podcast from Microsoft and the Globe Content Studio.
You know, if we're talking about AI in medicine, we wanted to start off big by seeing what AI might do for medicine's biggest, hardest, and most pressing issues.
So I'm thinking we're going to be talking about cancer.
Exactly. That's the big thing, right?
Yeah.
So I sat down with Benjamin Habe Keynes, a researcher with the University Health Network, or UHN. He's a senior scientist at Princess Margaret Cancer Research Center here in Toronto, which is one of the country's most important sites for cancer research. They're now turning to AI to tackle both how we diagnose and treat cancer.
Okay.
Here's Benjamin Habe Keynes.
So we are very far away from AI is going to replace doctors. And not only AI has many limitations, but it's kind of a silly objective. You know, in all those movies, like they plug that device to the patient and then you scan everything and boom. You say, okay, you know, treatment in process, like almost no human interactions. We are very far from this, mainly because we barely understand the biology behind most of the diseases. And because that level of data is very hard to collect systematically. So there will always be some interactions between the clinicians and the algorithm to really make the best of the two worlds and learn from each other.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. It's one thing to apply AI to, say, finance, and a whole different ballgame to apply that to the human body.
It really is, because we still have so much to learn about not just AI, but the human body as well.
We don't know how Tylenol works.
Right. But there are some ways that AI is actually really invaluable. And while we're still not at that tricorder stage yet, where we can just kind of scan someone and see what's wrong with them, there are some parts of doctors' work where AI is actually a better fit than what we have currently. And one of that piece is imaging.
Okay, so like looking at scans.
Exactly. Here's Benjamin.
So AI has been shown to work very well with images, usually natural images, like you want to classify cats and dogs. But there are many, many applications in radiology. And I'm talking about those highly trained, highly paid individuals spend their time looking at, let's say, a CT scan with several slices of a tumor. So it's a massive, like 30 to 200 images for a given patient. And then they detect the tumor there and they spend their time circling the tumor on all those slices. So you can build a 3D model of the tumor. That sounds extremely tedious and error prone. And still, that's what people are doing in the clinic. So there are ways now to apply AI to kind of delineate that tumor much faster and potentially more accurately. So instead of spending 3 hours on a patient, they can do it in 10 minutes by just reviewing what the AI predicted and maybe corrected in some areas where the AI got it wrong. So that's basically optimizing an existing process.
Okay, so this tool is just speeding up the process, doing what the human doctor does, but faster.
Yeah, exactly. But then there are a second class of AI tools, and Becky, you're going to like this, and that's what Benjamin calls superhuman.
Oh.
You want to give clinicians tools to do things that they were not able to do before. If you take a CT scan and you look at it, you know, honestly, I'm not a trained radiologist. I barely see the tumor there. Even when you tell me where it is, the signal is pretty subtle. But radiologists are highly trained to find it. AI could find it as well. However, what AI could do that humans will have a hard time to do is to really dive deep into those grayscale intensities and try to understand if there is something special about that tumor. For instance, an easy thing that humans can do is just to look at the shape. If it's very round, it looks like the tumor is not really invading yet. If it's very spiky, it looks like the tumor is starting to invade the surrounding tissue. That's probably easy. But what about heterogeneity of the pixel intensities? Entropy, is it chaotic in there? There are many information that the machine is very good at extracting that the human, just using, you know, vision, could not extract. And that's where we think we could extract more information than the radiologist would ever do. So that's the kind of superhuman ability, because we will go further in terms of what we can do with those images.
And it's possible that this class of superhuman AI can innovate in ways that humans hadn't thought of, probably because they don't have the same kind of biases.
Okay, because that reminds me of what Heather, you know, the penguin scientist, what she said in our environment episode. The AI system doesn't go in with biases it's trying to confirm, so it might be more thorough.
And so then it can pass on those findings to human scientists.
Machine teaching instead of machine learning.
Exactly. Here's Benjamin.
It's not so much that AI is going to replace, but AI is going to push the limits of what we can do in certain area, and the doctors will learn from it. So those are mostly black boxes. And over time, we will probably be able to infer new patterns that will be then taught in medical schools. So I really believe that there will be some bidirectional interaction with machine and human to improve both in parallel.
So what Benjamin says about black boxes is really interesting, because it's one of the strangest aspects of AI. So the black box is the name that we've given to the phenomenon where you can put information into an AI system and you get a response back. So, but even the people who created the AI don't fully understand how we got the answer, which is fascinating and kind of creepy at once.
Yeah, that's basically the plot of every Fear the Future AI movie. We don't know why it's doing that. We didn't teach it to do that.
Exactly, right? But as Benjamin said, that's not going to be the future of medicine anytime soon.
Okay, that's kind of reassuring. I'd like to think that scientists have paid attention to all the Fear of the Future movies, and all the potential pitfalls are being taken into account. And I really like this idea of bidirectional learning, that we can teach the robots, but also learn from them and get better as humans.
Yeah, and when it comes to cancer, like, we really need all the help that we can get.
Yeah.
And so Benjamin's work is about applying AI tools to something that he calls pharmacogenomics.
Nice and easy to say.
Yeah. So pharmacogenomics is as complicated as it is hard to pronounce, but it basically means trying to create drugs that are tailored to an individual's genetic makeup.
Okay, hold on. So that's like Limitless in 2011, where Bradley Cooper is taking a designer drug in order to use the full capacity of his brain. But that's a bit different, because that wasn't for his specific genetic makeup, it was just a designer drug that only he had access to.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Kind of.
Okay.
Okay. So the upside is going to be much more personalized medicine. The downside is that it can be incredibly complex, expensive, and time-consuming. Here's Benjamin.
So pharmacogenomics is a little bit less mature in terms of AI application, mostly because this is not really the kind of data that AI has been demonstrated to work very well with. So for the moment, we are really at the baby steps. So what we do is that we take one gene at a time, and we are looking at that genomic location or gene and see whether it can predict alone drug response in specific tissue type. So now you can imagine you have 25,000 genes, to make it easy, coding for proteins, and you have, let's say, 40 different cancer types, and you look at all the possible associations. So it's a lot of possible associations. It's like multiple billions of those associations. And that's where we are collaborating with Microsoft to leverage the massive computational power available on Azure to mine that very, very systematically.
Yeah, that just doesn't sound feasible for humans alone.
Yeah, so his work is about leveraging big data, and you can use tools like Microsoft Azure's cloud computing to do something like that.
Okay.
Because solving problems like cancer requires A, huge computing power, and B, the ability to pass massive amounts of data securely, so they need tools they can trust and rely on to process huge data sets. So any organization that needs to store and analyze sensitive and regulated data, which is what medical data is,
yeah,
can use cloud platforms like Azure to make their work safer and more affordable. And at Princess Margaret, they're looking to create new ways to collect and organize their data. And they're setting out to make big changes with their own data science program that they're launching later in 2019.
That's exciting.
The idea behind this program is to aggregate all the data streams that we collect through the journey of the patient across the hospitals. And every hospital needs to get very, very good at this. You want a hyper-connected hospitals where the patient experience is more streamlined, not only quality of care, but also, you know, appointment and this kind of stuff. So I think what's going to happen in the future is that hospitals will get better and better at following the patients, collecting data along the way. Some going to be dirty, some going to be very clean. Some going to be like snapshot at a given time point, like a visit to the doctor. Some's going to be more longitudinal over time, like using wearable devices. I think the whole biomedical community is very excited about wearable devices because it's a non-invasive way to collect data over time about patients that otherwise we would not be able to collect because you cannot ask the patient to come every day to the hospital. So I think working in the community with patients using those new technologies is going to be a game changer for AI to really shine.
So by wearable devices, he's talking like Fitbits?
Yeah. So right now we have things that you wear on your wrist, but in the future we're going to have things like headphones that can take your heart rate.
Oh, that's so cool. But I want to bring us back to, he's just said dirty data. What is dirty data?
Well, it's not your browsing history.
Ooh.
It is, generally speaking, inaccurate or outdated or incomplete data. Basically, it's data that has gotten corrupted in some way. So it's very hard for AI to give good results when it's working with imperfect data sets.
Yeah, so it's bad information in, bad information out, and we can't work from that data.
Yeah. So if you're feeding an algorithm imperfect data, it's not going to give you perfect results. It's almost like cooking, right?
Yeah.
If you put in something bad, it's going to turn out bad. And just think about how much dirty data there could be in a medical field. You could have different doctors collecting the data at different clinics or different hospitals, and it's about the human body, which is complicated and it's changing all the time. It's a complete minefield.
There's a whole bunch of different factors here.
Yeah. Sometimes people call dirty data noisy data, right? And what that means is that there's just so much information that it's hard to tell what to trust and what's even relevant. So it's important for that data to be streamlined.
Which is what they're developing in this new program at Princess Margaret.
Yeah, and Benjamin gave me a great example of how even the most precisely collected data can still be really complicated.
Even in imaging, there is something called the coffee break test. You take an image with a patient, then you go for a coffee and you take the same image. They're not going to perfectly align. We're getting much, much better at aligning two images, but the patient is always moving a little bit. 15 minutes apart, you don't expect the tumor to change dramatically, but there are still phenomena in your body that may change the image a little bit. So repeating the image and not exactly getting the same kind of measurement is a challenge for machine learning. You would rather have like measurements that are very stable.
So the human body is a complicated mess of systems, and AI wants tidy data. It's like a little Rosie from the Jetsons, overcompensating.
Yeah, exactly. And we're going to leave Benjamin there and let him continue his important work of literally curing cancer.
After the break, we're going to talk to another researcher who's applying AI to medicine in a very different field to a very different group of patients. And we'll dig into why we don't have diagnostic tricorders at the walk-in clinic yet. Come on, what is the holdup, guys? I'm ready.
This and more just up next.
We're living in a time of massive change, and the signs are all around us. It's in our businesses making sense of big data, in our hospitals as new technologies help doctors diagnose and prevent illnesses, and even in our homes as devices streamline your day so you can focus on what matters. This is the invisible revolution, and it's powered by innovative technologies. Microsoft is integrating artificial intelligence across all its products and services to extend the capabilities of individuals and organizations. With a powerful, trusted platform of AI services and tools, they're transforming business and enabling innovation. They believe in an AI future that makes things better for your planet, your business, and you. Join the AI revolution with Microsoft and achieve more. So, Nav, I feel like you and Benjamin took us through a few of the successful applications of AI so far, and you definitely gave us some context about the complexity of bringing AI to the hospital. But I'm still sitting here wondering when the future is coming to my GP's office.
Yeah.
So to learn more and demand a cure for the common cold, I sat down with Anna Goldenberg, the newly appointed first chair in biomedical informatics and artificial intelligence at SickKids Hospital in Toronto. She doesn't even have a business card, and that title is too badass to fit on one.
It's certainly a mouthful.
Totally. You know, we tell a lot of jokes in this podcast, but I know it's really hard to even think about kids getting seriously sick. Luckily, we have people like Anna and her brilliant team hard at work applying AI to kids in critical care. And she spoke about one project she's developing which could predict cardiac arrest in these young patients before it even happens. And it really drove home for me the importance of collaboration between the researchers and clinicians in developing AI tools. Here's Anna Goldenberg.
This happened as a collaboration with the intensive care unit. And the idea was, it was very interesting to me. We met and they know their data really well. And we don't know their data when we know the machine learning part. So we met and we started discussing what kind of questions would have immediate impact or be really important to answer in a critical care. And they said, well, this is a low frequency event, the cardiac arrest, but it's really a devastating event. So if we could predict it early and we could prevent it, would really serve a great purpose. So then we basically received the data and we had meetings every couple of weeks with my students and with the engineers and their team, with the clinicians and their team. And we basically developed something that would show the results and say, well, we're not sure about this. And iteratively, we actually got to the results that we were really excited about. We got, for 70% of the patients, we can predict within 5 minutes whether cardiac arrest is about to happen in 5 minutes, right? And we are constantly refining the system to make it more personalized. And maybe for some of the individuals, we'll be able to predict even earlier.
That is absolutely mind-blowing. Noticing the markers in that five-minute window before cardiac arrest could be the difference between a full recovery and a debilitating, life-altering consequence for kids.
So the collaboration you mentioned, rather than it being a kind of like us versus them dynamic when it comes to doctors and AI, it kind of sounds like this might actually work.
Yeah, it's like everybody's on the same team. And that way they can develop something that medical professionals are actually going to use that's going to augment their current skills. It fills the gaps in the knowledge where doctors used to rely on like gut instinct or hunches and offers actual data to help figure out complicated medical problems. It's a good thing the show House has ended. Otherwise, with this new technology, the episodes would end up being like 3 minutes long. They'd be like, computer, here's the details.
I mean, that would be a real challenge for the medical drama industry for sure. Mm-hmm. And no more Sandra Oh in Grey's Anatomy would be a real loss for me personally. I haven't watched that show in like a decade. But it must be so rewarding for Anna that her work can be implemented in like a tangible, real way like that.
Like everything, it's a bit more complicated than that. Here's Anna on where they are in the process.
So we have a paper that was presented at the conference, and now we are using it as a proof of principle for the AI and medicine initiative to implement it, to translate it to the clinic. But there are many steps in that process. And what it entails is we have to test it so that the clinician does not see the decision, but we actually recording what we are predicting. So kind of a silent mode. Then if it performs in silent mode in the clinic, as clinicians expect. And of course, they will have to decide, well, does it help them enough? Will they use it? So then, if that works, we would have to kind of incorporate it into the system and have a trial if they would be interested in looking at the predictions in real time. And that involves the designers, that involves people who know how to run clinical trials, that involves testing for a lot of the things that can go wrong. And then if that works, then we would try to incorporate it in a clinic. It will take a couple of years. So within this couple of years, we will have a tool that we know that it works in a clinic and that the clinicians are happy to use it and maybe slowly incorporating it in.
So for something that's looking good on paper and even in small scale trials, it seems like a really slow process.
Oh, it is. And I asked Anna why, with the evidence we have of the potential, it's not just being rushed into hospitals right away. Why aren't we releasing the technological hounds knowing that we potentially have a solution? Well, there's a lot of things to take into account, things like government regulation, hospital policy, and of course, user interface issues.
It's a wild west in terms of how this kind of technology is being implemented in the hospitals. And I think as we are ramping it up, there will be lessons learned and hopefully deployment lessons learned and circulated. So how do we figure that into the pipeline where the safety and efficacy has to be maintained? I think these are incredibly important, but also interesting and challenging questions that we are trying to solve right now as part of the AI in medicine initiative, but I think globally in machine learning and healthcare.
Along with some of her colleagues, Anna is currently writing a piece about guidelines for best practices when it comes to implementing these tools, because in a lot of ways, these regulations don't even exist yet. It's stuff that we haven't even conceived of yet, so how do we make rules about it? And to get these revolutionary AI tools into use, we're going to need safe and streamlined ways to test them. Here's Anna.
So we are writing guidelines towards responsible machine learning in healthcare. So this is for anybody who wants to work on developing new machine learning tools. What do they have to be aware of, and what are the different steps, and what are the kind of the hidden stones or hidden dragons, as people say, to make sure that you don't develop a harmful tool, right? Because if we are not thoughtful about biases in the system, right, there's a lot of inequality in healthcare. If we're not thoughtful about how to address it in our algorithms, we might be reinforcing it or making it worse. So all kinds of thoughts about how to select a problem, how to deal with the data, all of these things are not necessarily intuitive to the people who are just coming into the field and saying, oh, the tools are out there, we can do it. For a lot of us who have been in this field for a while, we want to make sure that newcomers approach this field very responsibly, and that's what these guidelines were for. There has to be a balance between regulating and being able to innovate still. And I think the regulators and the policymakers will have to make some of these decisions, and I don't envy them. It's going to be hard.
Anna said that in a lot of ways, the healthcare industry, especially in Canada, is risk-averse.
But in a lot of ways, I can understand why that's the case.
Oh, yeah, for sure. But we also want to be able to innovate. So getting our policy to reflect that balance Anna talked about without making each process impossibly lengthy and expensive is going to be the key. This also encourages researchers from other places to come to Canada where they can be supported and see their work really come to life.
So Anna also mentioned something about addressing biases in the data. What kind of biases is she talking about?
Okay, right. So we talked about this. In a lot of cases, we think of data as being neutral and unbiased, objective, right? There's a reason why the next generation's collected and calmed data is named, well, data. But that's not the reality. Data always contains biases from how it was collected, who collected it, when and where. Here's Anna.
Majority of the data that we have in the research studies, we have for Caucasians. For example, in breast cancer, we have Caucasian females. And the predictors that we build for what makes you more likely to get cancer or what kind of treatment should be used, it doesn't actually apply to males that get breast cancer. It's much more rare. It also does not apply to African Americans and people with other ethnicities. So we know that we can treat one sort of subset of the population, but people who are generally more disadvantaged settings do not have a chance of getting because simply we didn't have enough data on them or something like that. So that is certainly something that we have to keep addressing in the machine learning area. But again, a lot of machine learning methods are data hungry, especially deep learning. And first, we have to specify that it will work only in this population. But second, we have to try to make a better effort in figuring out how it will work in other populations. What can we do to augment it so that it would work in these populations? We are bound by the data that we have, and we have to be aware of that.
And that's becoming a really common theme in our conversations around machine learning, that AI and algorithms are data hungry, which means that AI requires an immense amount of information to give good results. So if we're feeding the algorithms data about only Caucasians, the results it gives will only safely apply to Caucasians. And that's something everybody needs to be concerned about.
So what you're saying is that researchers have to think not just about what they do with data, but the biases in where the data comes from.
Exactly. Medical data is complicated because it's personal. And there are so many ethical boundaries to overcome. And when it comes to developing data-hungry AI tools, they have to make sure that everyone involved knows how and why their data is being collected. Here's Anna.
So I think what has to happen going forward is to really educate the public better about what are the benefits and the drawbacks of having their data being used for research. What we don't want is something bad to happen to the patients because their data has been shared. We don't want that. But a lot of times we can bring a lot of good by using this data. So there has to be a lot of information and literature and education and sessions probably from the AI community as well as the hospital. And we have a data governance and ethics task force as part of our AI and medicine to specifically address this point and to get this information to the patients, to involve patient advocates, to see how people feel and what kind of information they want to know to want to share their data.
Again, it's about collaboration and communication with the patients, patient advocates, computer scientists. It's the responsibility of the researchers to explain exactly what the data is being used for, why it's important, how it's being collected and protected.
Yeah, we talk about privacy a lot these days, and I think with good reason. But I feel like in a situation like this, I'd actually be kind of open to sharing my data.
Would you?
Yeah, I don't know. Is that just me? But I feel like the really important thing is that you have to give people the option to opt in.
Okay. Yeah, I get that because I think I would feel similarly if it was being explained to me how my data was being used, why it was important, and how many people I was actually helping. Give me some numbers, people. I am data hungry. And we can talk up collaboration as if everybody's on the same team. But, you know, if I were a doctor, I'd be concerned about what my role is here. Not every doctor is on board with these AI changes.
Some of the clinicians that are very skeptical about using this technology, they say that it has to be completely explainable. And I think it's interesting that people think that explainability might mean exactly how you made this decision. But sometimes you can't tell. And clinicians that I work with, which I just love every one of them, they say, well, you know, sometimes I make a decision based on my gut feeling, and I actually don't know. I wouldn't be able to explain. I can try to post reverse engineer the way that I've made this decision, but I might not always be able to. I just feel that this is the right decision to make, especially with the more senior clinicians that have seen a lot, and they kind of have this gestalt, right? And I think what people want to be able to trust the system is to see how the system would respond to different kinds of scenarios. And I think we as machine learning experts have the responsibility to let people know how the system would react to different kinds of situations.
This reminds me of the black box thing that we talked about earlier.
Yeah, okay, totally. And I love how Anna points out that we humans are black boxes sometimes too. Intuition or gut response, you know, however you want to put it. We can make decisions that are hard to break down step by step. Like, what am I having for dinner? I want tacos. Why do I want tacos? I can't break it down. I just want to feel the heat.
That's true, but it seems like it's really important to still have buy-in from both doctors and their patients too, so that AI developers aren't just working in a vacuum.
Exactly, and to do that takes time to make tools out of it that are going to serve everybody.
And it makes sense to be careful in that way, because when it comes to healthcare, these are high stakes, right? So people want to get this right.
Exactly. And I can get behind all that, even if it means I am going to have to wait for my own personal tricorder.
I mean, that's probably not going to come anytime soon. But while we're waiting for that, these tools are being developed on a day-to-day basis. And we don't know what this conversation is going to sound like in 2 or 5 or 10 years from now. It might be completely different.
Exactly. And I think because this is such a complicated topic, and really this is as deeply as we can get into it in a half-hour conversation, we're going to leave the AI and medicine conversation there. Thanks to Benjamin Habe-Keynes and Anna Goldenberg for sharing their groundbreaking research with us. You are both so cool.
And thank you for listening to another episode of AI Meets World from Microsoft and the Globe Content Studio. I'm Navneet Alack.
And I'm Becky Shrimpton.
This podcast is produced by Pippa Johnstone, and executive producers are Stephanie Chan and Kieran Rana.
If you're satisfied with your care, throw us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts and tell your friends and your huggable, non-threatening healthcare companions.
And don't forget to hit subscribe so you can follow along next week as we take you to school to meet the workforce of tomorrow.
And guys, they're really impressive.